The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. In this broadcast, I'm going to follow up on some of the points I made in last week's broadcast on ignorance and arrogance of American politicians. As I said in that broadcast, a striking expression of the corruption of America's social political life and of American decline is the ignorance and arrogance of its prominent politicians. I quoted at some length from statements made by leading Republican candidates at the so-called presidential candidates debate in Washington, D.C. on November 22nd. And I emphasized that with the notable exception of Ron Paul, the candidates showed that they lack principle, a coherent worldview, or a reality-based understanding of history. There was a lot of empty feel-good rhetoric about American exceptionalism and a lot of craven pandering to Jewish Zionist power. But the upshot of it is that the performance and the rhetoric of these individuals is such that they would be considered unfit for any position of authority or responsibility in a healthy or educated society. Now, this has not escaped the attention and notice of people outside the United States. A lengthy commentary on the Republican Party crop of candidates for president appeared recently in Der Spiegel, one of the most influential and widely read European publications. Der Spiegel is a weekly magazine, something like Time or Newsweek, although it is read widely, of course, online in both German and in English, and is very influential and also representative of educated opinion across Europe. In this commentary in Der Spiegel, which was headlined "The Republicans' Farcical Candidates, a Club of Liars, Demagogues, and Ignoramuses," the writer said this: "It's horrifying because these eight so-called would-be candidates are eagerly ruining not only their own reputations and that of their party, the party of Lincoln Lore, worse, they're ruining the reputation of the United States. They lie, they cheat, they exaggerate, they bluster, they say one idiotic, ignorant, outrageous thing after another. They've shown such stark lack of knowledge, political, economic, geographical, historical, that they make George W. Bush look like Einstein and even cause their fellow Republicans to cringe. All these dopes have to offer are ramblings that insult the intelligence of Americans." The commentary highlighted, for example, the behavior of Newt Gingrich, who is a current favorite of the Republican Party. In fact, a recent poll shows that he's now positioned to be the most popular candidate in the Iowa State straw poll campaign. The Der Spiegel commentary calls him a political dinosaur, dishonored and discredited, or so we thought. Yet just because he studied history and speaks in more complex sentences than his rivals, the U.S. media now reflexively hails him as a man of ideas. That's what the Washington Post called Gingrich. Pompous and blustering, Gingrich gets away with this selling himself as a Washington outsider, despite having made millions of dollars as a lobbyist in Washington. At least the man's got chutzpah. The hypocrisy doesn't end there. Gingrich claims moral authority on issues such as the sanctity of marriage, yet he's been divorced twice, and he cheated on his second wife just as he was pressing ahead with Bill Clinton's impeachment during the Monica Lewinsky affair, unaware, seemingly, of the irony. The woman he cheated with, by the way, was one of his House aides and 23 years his junior. As Der Spiegel goes on, Americans have a short memory. They forgot, too, a point that I was emphasizing last week, that Gingrich was driven out of Congress in disgrace, the first Speaker of the House to be disciplined for ethical wrongdoing. Or that Gingrich enjoyed a $500,000 credit line at Tiffany's, the New York jewelry center, just as his campaign was financially in the toilet and he ranted about the national debt. Chutzpah indeed. Mitt Romney is hardly better. The eternal flip-flopper and runner-up, who by now is almost guaranteed to clinch the nomination, even though no one in his party seems to like or want him. I would add here, though, that the campaign has been so fluid and the enthusiasms have waxed and waned so rapidly that I think it's too early to say for sure that Mitt Romney is almost, as the Spiegel says, guaranteed to clinch the nomination. But the Spiegel article goes on. What a nice club that is. A club of liars, cheaters, adulterers, exaggerators, hypocrites, and ignoramuses. It notes that a writer for the magazine The New Yorker called this a starting point for a chronicle of American decline. And finally, the Der Spiegel commentary goes on to say that the U.S. elections are a reality show after all, a pseudo-political counterpart to the Paris Hiltons, Kim Kardashians, and all the American Idol and X Factor contestants littering today's TV. The cruder, the dumber, the more bizarre and outlandish, the more lucrative. Well, it's a worthwhile point, and it's one I've made myself, comparing the abysmal performance, the sorry rhetoric of these political candidates, not merely in the Republican Party, of course, the Democratic Party is hardly any better, but the character, the format of these candidates compared to the leaders that America used to be able to produce. None of them have the weightiness, the seriousness of a Thomas Jefferson or a James Madison or even Abraham Lincoln. It's worth comparing the slipshod, soundbite, short way that candidates now talk in slogans in America with the level of political discourse even 20 or 30 years ago, certainly compared with what it was a century ago. Anyone reading the transcripts, for example, of the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the 1850s, before Lincoln was president, cannot help but be struck by the high level of intelligence or thoughtfulness that was required for audiences to follow the often very involved explanations and presentations that Lincoln and Douglas presented in these debates. But even during the 1940s or 50s, the level of political discourse in America was markedly more intelligent than it is today. Today it's been reduced to sound bites and slogans that count on a public with a very, very short attention span and almost no memory at all, certainly no historical memory or understanding. Now, of the Republican candidates, two that have been especially prominent in emphasizing a theme that seems to be a big one these days of American exceptionalism is Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney. Although they're not alone, it seems almost obligatory now for Republican candidates or for candidates across the board to talk about their belief in what they call American exceptionalism, that this country is not only different from other countries in the world, it's better than other countries in the world. It's morally superior to other countries in the world. An interesting piece in this regard appeared in the Atlantic magazine about Newt Gingrich, and quoted Gingrich recently, making a statement so arrogant and stupid that it's an insult to other countries around the world, an insult to America's, even America's allies. In a talk, Gingrich said this, and I'm quoting, "My dad served 27 years in the Army. I watched my mother through that whole period, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. I think what makes us different, and what makes us, in some ways, when we have good leadership, much more ruthless and much tougher than any country in the world, is we don't send soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen to war. We send our children. We send our fathers. We send our brothers and sisters. We send our mothers. And therefore, there's a preciousness to this decision, unlike any other country I know of." Well, it's breathtaking, not only how ignorant such a statement is, but how arrogant it is. Newt Gingrich is saying that Americans care more for their loved ones than any other people in the world, that people in Britain or Russia or Japan or Germany or Italy or other countries care less, don't love their fathers or mothers or sisters as much as Americans do. They don't have the same sense of what he calls preciousness. Well, this is ludicrous. It's insulting. It should be insulting to Americans who hear it. But I guess it's an expression of the low level of what American political life has fallen to, that there are people who hear that kind of talk and find it appealing, that agree with it. In fact, the idea that Americans care more for the lives of their soldiers is very hard to believe when one considers that the United States has sent more troops into more wars than perhaps any other country in modern history. Since World War II alone, America has bombed more countries, invaded more countries, attacked more countries than any other nation around the world. And yet it's astonishing the extent that, in spite of this record, Americans like to believe that the United States is a more peace-loving, peaceful country than any other in the world. It's real chutzpah, it's real arrogance, astonishing effrontery to uphold such an idea. The article goes on in the Atlantic. What would President Gingrich tell the Turks, Chinese, Europeans, or Italians? That they don't believe in liberty, or even worse, that they don't care much about the human toll of war? Gingrich has been at the forefront of this talk about American exceptionalism. He published a book entitled A Nation Like No Other, Why American Exceptionalism Matters. He and his wife, his third wife, by the way, Callista, produced and co-star in a documentary produced earlier this year entitled A City Upon a Hill, The Spirit of American Exceptionalism. A trailer for the film describes exceptionalism as the idea that America is, quote, more open, more vigorous, more optimistic than other nations. Gingrich's own personal definition has more to do with God and small government, which happen to be lodestars for conservatives. And his starting point is the Declaration of Independence, which says the Creator has endowed all men with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This idea of American exceptionalism, as I've emphasized, is not only wrong, it's dangerous, because it's built upon wishful thinking, it's built upon a kind of mythologized view of America's past and its future, that during a time of real crisis and difficult and decline in American life, is all the more out of place. What is required today is not more wishful thinking and empty rhetoric about American exceptionalism, but greater sobriety, greater realism, not less. Of course, when Gingrich says, as he did in that quote I said, that, well, America is more ruthless and tougher when we have good leadership, what he means is, vote for me. If I'm president, I'll be a good leader that'll make America more tough than any other country in the world. Of course, that's just, it's pandering and demagoguery to his audience. But more than that, this idea that America is more open, one of the implications of that, and Newt Gingrich has spelled it out, is that American borders should be more open than those of any other country in the world. That's one of the expressions of this idea of American exceptionalism, that to uphold the idea, America has to be a more universal, more open society than any other. That is, it has a country with no coherent cultural, ethnic, or religious character. Instead, it's a universal country. As the idea that America is more optimistic than other nations. Well, optimism, of course, is a good thing. But if it's not based on reality, it's simply childish, wishful thinking. And that increasingly characterizes much of American life. Time and again, educators have pointed out that some of the poorest performing American high school students, especially in inner cities in the United States, have inflated ideas of their own ability. They think they're far more capable than they actually are. In contrast, in some countries around the world where the students actually perform far higher on standardized tests, they don't have anywhere near the inflated or optimistic or upbeat idea of their abilities than do many Americans who are actually less able, less performing, less competent than their counterparts in other countries. The idea, too, that for many conservatives, the whole point of America is to uphold life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is also a dangerous notion, especially in the United States today. Of course, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are worthwhile things. But if they become the standard for a nation, it sets the bar very low. Even the most lazy person sitting on his behind in Jamaica believes in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But pursuing happiness says nothing about the level of ability or achievement or culture or virtue in a society. It becomes merely a almost aimless search for self-gratification, or can be. And that's, to a large extent, of what American life has turned into. Because life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are not really goals in and of themselves. They're sort of negative goals, things that we that are preconditions for real achievement or real ability. Again, a society dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is characteristic of the most backward countries in the world. Countries with higher standards of living, that are more orderly, cultured, capable, and so forth, are characterized much more by a sense of responsibility, a sense of community, a sense of duty. Another article appeared the other day in the National Catholic Reporter on exceptionalism. That's worth considering. This and takes aim at this idea that American exceptionalist idea that America is not only different from other countries, but it's superior. That greatness is somehow inherent in the United States. That the values of the United States are somehow higher. And that America's so-called leadership of the free world is one that America deserves because we're great, because we're exceptional. And that no other country can match American achievements. Indeed, it's a self-satisfied view that America is a model for the world. But this is little more than a national pride gone wild, a kind of bragging or boastfulness about America. It's somewhere between wishful thinking and self-serving myth without a real groundedness in reality. But it's all the more laughable and absurd at a time of tremendous strain and crisis in American life. This is not only the economic problems in America, but the United States around the world, of all the so-called leading countries, is number one in its prison population per capita, in the murder rate, the rate of rape per capita. It's the country with the highest rate of obesity of any major industrial country in the world. Those are not things to be proud of. And before countries or leaders talk about American exceptionalism, giving themselves a big pat on the back, dealing with these problems is a far greater priority if America is to, and our country is to, be what it can be. Indeed, around the world, people increasingly look to the United States not as a model, but as a country with features to be avoided. Around the world, people do not look at American cities as models. They look at us as examples to avoid, not to be followed. A recent survey of cities around the world showed that Vienna was number one, with cities in Europe, almost all of them, almost all of the top cities were cities in Europe or in New Zealand. None of the top 20 or 30 cities on this list was an American city. And around the world, this is, people understand and see this. But for Americans who know very little of the rest of the world, they can just tell themselves and feel good, I suppose, about how great America is in spite of the real objective reality of the situation. Now, one of the most dangerous facets of, well, America is exceptional in some ways. There is a basis for the idea of American exceptionalism that does have a basis in reality. It has to do with the uniqueness of American history. The central fact of American history is that it was a country settled by people from Europe who were able to take possession of a continent with very little effort, filled with enormous resources, huge forests, millions of acres of arable land, of good quality soil, of a country with petroleum reserves, with gold, silver, mineral wealth, and no major hostile neighbors to impede the rapid takeover of the United States of this territory from the natives, who were sparsely distributed, and the native Indians had no technology, and so they were easily subdued. And that's the essential reason why America was able to expand so rapidly. The emphasis on getting ahead and doing well as an individual is a central feature of American history. And in many ways, it's an admirable thing. It allowed and promoted tremendous social mobility and taking advantage of opportunities, which were very important in exploiting the American continent rapidly during especially the 19th and early 20th centuries. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Pepe, good evening. Moscow was annoyed by Hillary Clinton's remarks after she labelled the elections, quote, unfree and unfair. Why would the State Department go for such a bold statement, do you think?
Because this is standard procedure for the State Department, you know, interfering in other people's elections. Sometimes directly, like in the Arab Spring, sometimes indirectly, as in the case of Russia. What they should... You know, they should be looking at the score of the Communist Party, which is almost 20% in the elections. They should be worried about that. 20% of voters in this latest election in Russia, in fact, they want to go back to 75 years of Russian history. This is much more important from an American point of view than the fact that the United Russia got 49% of the votes, which any party in a Western democratic system would love to have as well.
Now, the foreign ministry stressed that the U.S. shouldn't lecture Russia about how to conduct elections. In fact, the American voting system itself has often been criticized, isn't it, as being far from being ideal.
Well, look, we had a stolen election in 2000. We had a semi-stolen election in 2004 in Ohio, not in Florida. This is documented. Everybody knows that, even in the U.S. We have Hillary Clinton going recently to Uzbekistan and praising the progress in Uzbekistan. Probably she means progress that Karimov is not boiling opponents anymore. So, you know, it's an enormous hypocrisy. In fact, I would say the most important thing for the Russians who are protesting the results of the elections would have to be what kind of project United Russia has for the country for the next 10 years or so. I think this is the most important question.
Of course, all this going on with a backdrop of Moscow being pretty angry currently with the U.S. for building that anti-missile system around its borders and refusing nonetheless to guarantee it won't target Russia. What do you read into the comments about Washington's attitude to resetting relations these days, looking at the broader picture?
There's no reset, Kevin. I would say reset has been dead for the past few weeks, in fact, because of the missile defense controversy, because of, you know, in terms of the NDN, the Northern Distribution Network that goes into Afghanistan via Central Asia. It was thanks to Russia that the NDN exists. So if the U.S. keeps pressuring Russia like this, Moscow can suddenly say, okay, there's no NDN anymore. How are you going to resupply NATO and U.S. troops in Afghanistan from now on? So it's counterproductive, but it's part of the State Department rationale. Don't forget that next month start the caucus in Iowa, and we're going to have a lot of Russian bashing alongside China bashing as well. But here, in one of the breaks in Brazil, the elections in Russia.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. As I said before we went on break, the notion of American exceptionalism does have some basis in reality. It's based upon the extraordinary, the rapid rise of the United States in the late 18th and then the 19th and 20th centuries from a fairly backward country settled along the eastern seaboard into a country that expanded across the middle part and across the Midwest and then across the Western Plains and to the Pacific Ocean, and became during the late 19th and early 20th century the number one industrial power in the world, the number one industrial country. And then in the 20th century, especially after World War II, the dominant military, industrial, and financial and economic country in the world. This record is so remarkable that it's easy to be self-satisfied or boastful about this record. But there are this immense achievement, this amazing trajectory, didn't happen because Americans are morally superior to other countries or because Americans are more virtuous than other people. It happened for objective reasons. It happened because there was almost no one else in the North American continent to take the land from. And there was no hostile neighbors to prevent the rapid takeover of the North American continent, and because it was a continent with tremendous natural resources. Now, America is not the first country. Americans are not the first people to think of themselves as exceptional, as better. This has happened many times in history, and the way in which other countries have had notions of their own uniqueness or greatness or exceptionalism should be a warning to Americans today. One example of that is how the Chinese emperors and the Chinese Empire had a very self-satisfied view of itself, themselves, as the center of the world. In fact, the Chinese word for China is Middle Kingdom, the center of the world, and that all other countries are basically barbarian or backward. This self-satisfied, this arrogant view was a reason why China did not change and adapt during the challenge in the late 19th century, and it led to the humiliation of China during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and then finally to the collapse of the Chinese Empire in 1912, and then followed by years of terrible civil war. But there are other examples in history, too, of imperial nations, wealthy, powerful countries that, instead of adapting and dealing with problems, instead fall back on a kind of self-satisfied rhetoric about themselves. So America is hardly the first country in history where have a view of themselves as being more virtuous and better and superior to those of all other countries. In fact, in American history is, if anything, at least as brutal or as expanding as that of other countries. America, of course, wouldn't exist except that it was built on land taken from the natives, with very easily, though, because the native Indians, of course, were technologically very primitive and disorganized and uncoordinated, and so subduing the Indians was relatively easy for people from Europe who had guns and technology. American Indians did not have the wheel. They had not horses before they were introduced by the Spanish, and so the expansion of the United States was very easy for that reason. But giving ourselves morally superior airs about American virtue is also hypocritical or remarkable, given how America still had slavery up until 1860, long after the Civil War, after it had been either didn't exist or had been abolished in other countries. More than that, the spectacular American dominance of in the decades after World War II was due less to American virtue or exceptionalism than the fact that the United States emerged from World War II as the only industrial power that hadn't been destroyed during the war. So from 1945, at the end of World War II, up until about 1980, or certainly into the 1970s, America's dominance in the world was due in large measure to the weakness of the rest of the world. And that's one of the reasons why Americans have much less of a sense than other countries about just the how terrible and horrific and a war can be and how much suffering war entails. In fact, part of the central kind of mythology of the United States has to do with its role in World War II, as I've emphasized in a number of these broadcasts on many other occasions. If winning a war shows the virtue of a society and the superiority of a society, then the Soviet Union had every right to claim that World War II showed the superiority of the Soviet communist system of government and society. But of course, that's not true. There's a popular and dangerous view in America that good guys win wars and bad guys lose wars, and that countries that are prosperous because they're morally good countries. Well, this is a very arrogant and dangerous view. And in fact, except for the United States, and with the exception perhaps of the South during the American Civil War, America is very fortunate in that it has not lost wars in any large or dramatic way, in the way that Japan or France or Germany or other countries have, which have been defeated and had their lands occupied by foreign armies and foreign powers. Now, it's a remarkable and noteworthy thing that those candidates who talk the most about American exceptionalism are also candidates who are most fervent in their devotion to Israel. Because this notion of American exceptionalism for these people applies not just to the United States, but to Israel. One expression of that is that the United States does not hold itself or Israel to the same standards it demands of other countries. If other countries invade a neighbor, or if they torture people, that's condemned. But the same leaders who believe in American exceptionalism also insist that the standards that are applied to other countries do not apply to the United States, or the one country they say that we should be most voted to, Israel. And that's why, in the case of Michelle Bachmann, Newt Gingrich, and Mitt Romney, who are particularly vociferous and loud in talking about how exceptional America is, they are also candidates who are loud and vociferous in insisting that Israel is America's number one most important ally, and that America must be dedicated to defending Israel, not only its security, but its identity, ethnic, religious identity as a Jewish state. Now, Gingrich, for example, along with Romney and others, have said that if Israel is involved in a war with Iran, that the United States must back Israel in such a conflict. Now, this is extremely dangerous given the world climate we live in today. This is an expression, though, this devotion to Israel by not only Republican but also Democratic candidates is an expression not of any sincere love of Israel, but rather of a craven desire to get elected by appealing to those who have power in American society. And no single ethnic religious group in America has anything like the tremendous power and influence of the organized Jewish community, the so-called Israel lobby. And politicians who talk loudly about their love of Israel and their devotion to Israel are expressing not real sincere love for any country, but rather are showing their corrupt eagerness to get elected and to maintain themselves and their friends in office by getting support from those who do have power. The cravenness and the corruption of American politics and American political life is no better manifest than it is in the behavior of these Republican candidates. Just recently, the Republican Jewish Coalition decided that it would not invite Representative Ron Paul to a presidential candidate forum in Washington, D.C., because it condemned what it called Ron Paul's misguided and extreme views. Ron Paul had supported an amendment to that a bill that would have ended all U.S. aid to Israel, along with U.S. aid to Egypt, Jordan, and Pakistan. Of course, Israel is the number one recipient of U.S. Foreign aid. It gets about $3 billion a year in military aid alone. But Ron Paul is the one candidate who has shown a consistent, principled attitude. The one candidate who has stuck to his principles and his positions over the years, even when it's been unpopular to do so. In fact, any candidate or any politician who is really sincere in his principles, whether they are liberal or conservative, would be opposed or should be opposed to this bizarre U.S. alliance with Israel. If a person is a sincere conservative, then they should be interested first and foremost in American policy that is dedicated to what's best for the United States of America, for the American people, and for humanity, not what's good for a small foreign country that is not important in objective terms for American interests. If a person, and also authentic conservatives, real conservatives, would have a view of Israel that's consistent with that of longstanding American policy of avoiding any passionate attachment with a foreign country, which George Washington pleaded for in his famous farewell address. By the same token, if a person has sincere liberal principles, they would also end the U.S. so-called special relationship with Israel, because Israel violates those principles in its policy. If we applied to Israel the standards that America has insisted upon in the case of Iraq or Iran, the United States would be bombing Tel Aviv, invading the country, and arresting its leaders and putting them on trial for actions which were cited to justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq and of other countries. After all, Israel is the only country in the Middle East with a nuclear arsenal that is in complete violation of international standards about nuclear weapons. It's the only country in the Middle East that routinely violates United Nations Security Council resolutions. It is the only country in the Middle East that occupies territory of its neighbors. All of that is so obvious that the rest of the world shows that it understands that in time after time in votes taken in the United Nations, in which the United States and Israel and perhaps one or two tiny other countries are on one side and the entire rest of the world is on the other. But the American media is so beholden to Israel and Jewish Zionist interests that the American public is more misguided and more ignorant than that of the public of any other country with regard to the Middle East and the realities of the world in that way. In fact, so blatant is the U.S. support for Israel by American politicians that a commentary appeared a few days ago in a leading Israeli newspaper, Haaretz, which said that the contenders for the Republican presidential nomination, with the exception, of course, of Ron Paul, are so pro-Israel, so ardent in their expressions of support for Israel, that, as he said, many Americans have been taken aback at what could easily be portrayed as the subordination of American foreign policy to Israeli interests and the predominance of the Israel-Iran issue over every other foreign policy considered issue of the United States. He was warning that the U.S. support, that the support for Israel by these politicians is so obvious that they should, that it gives the impression of being merely craven. And Israeli leaders and American Jewish leaders, some of them, have been urging American political leaders to be less obvious in their ardent support for Israel. Mitt Romney, for example, has said that as president, the first country he would visit after assuming the office would be Israel to once again underscore America and his support for the Zionist state. On any objective, by any objective standard, of course, many other countries are far more important to the United States, militarily, economically, and so forth. The United States is much more important, objectively speaking, interests with Canada or Britain or Mexico or Germany or South Korea or Japan than it does with Israel. But the United States or the American leading American politicians don't make pledges to those countries in the way that they do to Israel. But the perhaps the biggest and most immediate danger is that this U.S. special relationship with Israel could lead to an American support for an Israeli attack against Iran, a strike that would have catastrophic, disastrous consequences for the Middle East and certainly in the long run for the United States and ultimately, as some commentators have stressed, even for Israel itself. There's nothing more dangerous in the history of foreign relations for a major country to be tied to a weaker and vulnerable country and allow itself to be dragged into a conflict in which it can no longer even control its own destiny. And that's the great danger right now, at least in the foreseeable future, of the U.S. relationship with Israel. One of the most laughable aspects of the support for Israel by the leading Republicans is that is their claim that President Barack Obama is not a real friend of Israel and that he's sold out Israel, or as Mitt Romney says, he's thrown Israel under the bus. Well, this is ridiculous. It's absurd. It's a lie, really. In fact, Barack Obama has shown by his policies an ardent devotion to the U.S. Alliance with Israel, U.S. support for Israel. And just the other week, he reassured a Jewish group in New York of his dedicated support for Israel and its interests. One result of this is that President Obama has become more popular, according to recent public opinion polls, in Israel itself. Because Israelis understand that for all the critical rhetoric from leading Republicans, Barack Obama, in his actual policies, has been completely beholden to and supportive of Israel. instead of a period of American exceptionalism, the talk about American exceptionalism has become all the more intense precisely because we're going through a period of actual decline, a period of greater crisis. In fact, polls show that more Americans than ever expect that life for their children will be less prosperous and secure than it has been for them. These polls also show that trust in major institutions and confidence in the system and the political leadership of the United States has fallen to historic lows. But as the United States becomes an ever more unrecognizable third world country, Americans are understandably concerned about the entrenched political paralysis, economic stagnation, an endemic social economic inequality, an erosion of national identity and purpose, increasing social polarization, and the broad distrust we see around the world toward the United States. More Americans than ever are questioning long-held assumptions and are asking hard questions about our society's direction and its guiding principles. In this climate, it's understandable then that politicians, instead of providing real guidance or leadership or answers for these problems, instead respond with rhetoric about how wonderful we are. But this is why that's all the more dangerous, because objectively, the problems of America are greater than perhaps any time in our history. Certainly the prospects for the future are dimmer than they have been for many, many years. It's one of the reasons, therefore, that the work of the IHR in that regard is all the more important. This is a period of great opportunity because more Americans are questioning long-held assumptions about our past, our place in the world, and so forth. And for that reason, it's all the more important to try to reach especially younger people who must and should and must be leaders in the future if our country and our people is to have a future. We've been doing more and more in that regard to reach out to people in a way that we have not focused in the past. And the IHR, more than perhaps any other group of its kind in the United States, holds regular meetings to foster and cultivate a support among local people here in Southern California. We held a meeting a few weeks ago at which Michael Polignano and Gregory Johnson spoke, who both run the Countercurrents Publishing Venture in Northern California. And I spoke as well at this meeting, and we'll be holding another meeting this month at which Paul Fromm and I will be speaking about some of the issues that I've been dealing with here in today's broadcast. And I've been, of course, very pleased at the way that many of these podcasts on the Voice of Reason Network have been reaching people as well. The broadcast that I did a few weeks ago on Hitler's how Hitler tackled unemployment and revived Germany's economy has been particularly well received, and this has gotten more attention and generated more interest than any other broadcast I've done in recent weeks. In fact, somebody made it into a video. It's gone around on the internet, and a expanded text, revised and expanded text of that broadcast is now posted on our website, and it's also been widely distributed. During this time in American history, when there is this level of confusion and anxiety about the future, the work of the Institute for Historic Review and of those who associated with the Voice of Reason Network is all the more important and worthy of your support.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.